Mark Gantos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Today is Good Friday, the 6th of April, 2007. Mark Glenn is going to be with me at 8 o'clock this morning, Central Standard Time, and he will be with me from 8 to 10, Central Standard Time, helping me to evaluate the last week in terms of some of our guests and shows, and talking about all kinds of subjects related to things Middle Eastern, and related to things Jewish, both domestically and internationally. Mark is working on a major story, by the way, on the USS Liberty for the American Free Press. I don't know the exact time frame in which that is supposed to come out, but I know it's going to come out in the very near future, and it's one of the things I'll ask him about when he comes on at 8 o'clock, chatting about that article and what prompted it, and some of the experiences he's had in conducting some of his interviews to get that article ready. I've mentioned as well that Dr. Hesham Talawi, who has his own show on the Republic Broadcasting Network on Saturdays, is doing a lot of great things related to this USS Liberty situation. This last week, this last Tuesday on CurrentIssues.tv, Dr. Talawi was interviewing Ward Boston, who was a legal counsel to the U.S. Navy committee that was looking into, or board of inquiry looking into this whole business of the USS Liberty. I have not yet had the opportunity to watch that Hesham Talawi interview with Ward Boston, but I understand that Mark Glenn was also a part of that TV show that night, which you can find at currentissues.tv. And in that regard, I wanted to mention that I'm very, very grateful to Al Jazeera.info. Al Jazeera.info has informed me today. Their editor has, Dr. Hassan El-Najjar, that the post that I did on this interview for Breaking All the Rules News is mentioned today specifically at aljazeera.info. I'll read a little bit from this post. It is titled BATR's American Memory. BATR, of course, is Breaking All the Rules News. BATR's American Memory, Hesham Talawi interview with Ward Boston. The text goes on to say that BATR's American Memory has posted links to Dr. Hesham Talawi's Current Issues TV interview of April 3rd with Captain Ward Boston, senior counsel to the U.S. Navy's Board of Inquiry into the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty on June the 8th, 1967. Boston was ordered to say nothing about the investigation publicly 40 years ago, but has now broken silence in the wake of U.S. bankruptcy judge Jay Crystal's publication of information on the USS Liberty in the form of a book that indicates that the Israeli contention that the attack was an accident is correct. Links to the website of Mark Glenn of Crescent and Cross and the American Free Press, for whom Mr. Glenn is writing a major story in the USS Liberty for near-term publication nationwide, are also provided by American Memory. And then aljazeera.info goes on to run the URL that leads directly into my post for American Memory, alerting people as to the Hesham Talawi currentissues.tv show this past Tuesday, where Ward Boston and Mark Glenn were the guests. And it makes reference to the fact, of course, that I am working for the Republic Broadcasting Network, and there is a very nice user-friendly URL posted at aljazeera.info today that leads directly to the Republic Broadcasting Network, which you, of course, can find at republicbroadcasting.org. We've got a number of things to talk about this morning before Mark Glenn comes on at 8 o'clock. There is a very, very curious story today, and one that I have noted before as being a part of the evidence of a most bizarre situation in American Middle Eastern foreign policy as it relates to things Iranian. CNN has a front page post this morning that was posted at 1:32 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time entitled United States Protects Iranian Opposition Group in Iraq. This group is called the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, M-E-K. That stands for the Army of the People or People's Army. And it's a very, very fascinating, contradictory story in regard to American policy in that region. And as, of course, as I have mentioned earlier in the week, I have finished the book put out by the American Free Press on what the United States did, the CIA did in Iran in 1953. That volume is well worth your time because it gets into the story not simply from the vantage point of analysis, but it talks about this whole thing as far as reproducing some of the documents from that time that were internally generated by the U.S. and British intelligence communities that show just how deeply we were involved in manipulating events in that country and ultimately being involved in the overthrow of a foreign government that we did not think was in our interest to support or to recognize. Why do I bring this up? The reason I bring it up is that it's one of a series of things related to our policy in that part of the world in the last half century, related to Iran specifically and the Middle East generally, that may make very little sense in regard to what we're doing there, and may underscore once again that George Washington knew exactly what he was talking about in his farewell address, where he specifically mentioned that this country needed to avoid an interventionist foreign policy and needed to avoid entangling foreign alliances and needed to avoid foreign wars that were not in the interest of our people and that could not stand the test of scrutiny constitutionally or otherwise. If you look at the CNN story today entitled U.S. Protects Iranian Opposition Group in Iraq, you see what I'm talking about in regard to this whole business of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, or M-E-K. When I lived in Iran years ago, the MEK was very, very much involved in trying to overthrow Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the then Shah of Iran. The Mujahideen-e-Khalq was advertising itself in those days as a so-called Islamic Marxist group. That seems to me like a contradiction in terms, but that's what the MEK termed itself as being, a so-called Islamic Marxist group. And more to the point, for purposes of this conversation, the MEK was involved in a series of killings in Iran in the 1970s that involved active duty American military personnel, that involved some American defense contractors then working for Rockwell International. And as I recall it vividly at the time, there were several employees, Iranian employees of the American embassy in Tehran, which in those days was located at Takht-e Jamshid and Roosevelt Avenues, that found themselves being murdered at the hands of agents of this Mujahideen-e-Khalq, or MEK. In those days, this organization was considered to be the enemy of the United States, the enemy of the government at that time that the United States was supporting in Iran, and was thought to have connections both to Islamic terrorists and the Soviet Union's intelligence agency, the KGB. Here we are all these years later, and now we see this incredible paradox going on that CNN reports on today on its front page, where on the one hand, the U.S. State Department considers the Mujahideen-e-Khalq to continue being a terrorist group. On the other hand, we find that supposedly the Mujahideen-e-Khalq is providing the American military with valuable intelligence on Iran, to quote CNN. The Iraqi government wants to get rid of these guys. They don't want them on Iraqi soil. And yet the great and interesting thing here is that at the same time, the American military is providing safe haven for the Mujahideen-e-Khalq to continue operating in Iraq and to be going back and forth between Iraq and Iran. What is going on with all of this? I think it suggests very strongly that here is another example of the unsustainability of an American policy in that part of the world that contains so many contradictions that it's really hard to understand how we can consider that policy to be cohesive, either when it comes to Iran specifically or the Middle East generally. And in that vein, we get right back to what we've discussed in recent days on this show, in regard to the USS Liberty. What is the significance of what happened there on June the 8th, 1967? Of course, we've had Gary Brummett on this show. We've had Commander Dave Lewis from the USS Liberty on this show. And our most recent guest, Phil Turney, who was on this week, is a member of the USS Liberty going back to June the 8th, 1967. He was a topside damage control officer at the time who personally witnessed and experienced some of the most horrific aspects of what happened in this Israeli attack in June of 1967. And when you talk to any of these fellows, they are absolutely bewildered by the fact that there they were serving on a U.S. Navy vessel, a vessel that had been commissioned by the National Security Agency to be involved in collecting intelligence data on behalf of the United States government and for the purpose of utilization by the American military for purposes that ostensibly were related to protecting the lives of our own people in that part of the world and implementing a foreign policy in that region of the world that, according to the advertisements of the United States government in the late 1960s, was in the interest of the American people. It seems to me that when we look at this whole business of the attack on the USS Liberty and the cover-up of the truth of that attack that followed, it becomes very apparent that we continue to fight this whole question, not only of involvement in foreign intrigues and foreign wars, but also the question of the role of the Israeli lobby in continuing to manipulate and to control American foreign policy in a way which suggests very strongly that that foreign policy is being driven by a foreign power, and that significant elements in the American government, both the executive and legislative branches, as well as our national security establishment, are operating more for the interests of Israel than they are for the interests of the United States. And once that sort of process begins, it seems to me that there's absolutely no way of telling where it ends. And in this particular situation, whether we're looking at the USS Liberty in 1967 or this utterly bizarre, contradictory policy that the United States has in place in regard to the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization of both Iran and Iraq, all of it underscores that we don't really know many times in terms of the right hand what the left hand is doing, and in terms of the left hand what the right hand is doing. It also encourages a suspicion, one that I share, that there are many unseen hands pulling a lot of strings in all of these things that have no relationship to bear whatsoever to the true interest of our nation or to the Constitution, which ostensibly underscores and undergirds what we believe about this country, why it exists, why it should continue to exist, and the proper venue which should define who and what it is. And I think that whether you're looking at Middle Eastern policy or you're looking at a foreign trade policy which has destroyed the manufacturing economic base of this country, or you're talking about these various building blocks in world government, the latest of which would appear to be the Security and Prosperity Partnership arrangement for a North American Union, all of this simply points to the fact that we are no longer the old American Republic. We are an American empire, ostensibly being utilized and manipulated in conjunction with central banking interests, petroleum conglomerates, and a Jewish lobby. Do those constituencies really represent your best interest and mine? Should we not be taking a closer look at what has happened in this country? I'm going to suggest that that's exactly what we should be doing, and that in effect, by allowing what has taken place to continue going on, we are going to lose more lives in a war that is not in our interest. We are going to see our trade and foreign policy continuing to be, in effect, enacted and executed by an elite that has an interest in all of this that is related to personal profit and gain, unrelated to the whole question of the well-being of the larger whole of the American public and the American Republic. And as we look at this whole situation, I think as it transpires in the Middle East, it may well be that that is the circumstance, that is the tragedy that is going to bring all of this to a very, very ugly head. What's going to happen in the days ahead? Obviously, I'm not God. I don't know. But I have my feeling here internally that we will be at war with Iran in the next year. Let's hope that that's wrong. And I believe that that will be one more step toward a direction in our lives that must absolutely be reversed by all of the political activism, responsible political activism and prayer that we can muster, for there is not much time left. Tom Englehart has a very, very important post today at TomDispatch.com by Noam Chomsky The title of that is Preventing War with Iran. And Dr. Chomsky emphasizes that stopping a war with Iran requires a strong, organized opposition. Now, you may recall that earlier in the week, Dr. Steven Snigosky and I were talking about the whole question of Lieutenant Commander John Sharp. Lieutenant Commander John Sharp is an Orthodox Roman Catholic who was recently relieved of his position as the public relations officer and public affairs officer for the USS Carl Vinson. Why? Well, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, it's because Sharp represents a point of view that is both anti-Semitic and supremacist, and in turn a violation, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, of Navy Regulation 1167, which prohibits U.S. Navy personnel from being involved in movements and organizations deemed to be quote-unquote anti-Semitic or quote-unquote supremacist. How does this relate to Noam Chomsky of MIT? Well, in a very significant way it does, because Lieutenant Commander John Sharp earned the wrath of the Southern Poverty Law Center and presumably the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith for being the editor and publisher of two volumes. One volume is entitled Neocon. The other volume is entitled Neocon Again. And Lieutenant Commander John Sharp has committed a great sin, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, in that he has questioned the wisdom of this country's involvement in Iraq, both in terms of Augustinian just war policy and just war theory, going back to St. Augustine's understanding of this subject many centuries ago. Lieutenant Commander John Sharp has also publicly questioned the wisdom and legitimacy of the foreign policy of the United States continuing to be driven by a foreign country. Sounds to me like Lieutenant Commander John Sharp is right on beam. And as you look at this whole absurdity of these charges that have been brought against Sharp by the Navy under the pressure of the Southern Poverty Law Center and ostensibly the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, you really wonder just how nutty all of this has to be when you look at Lieutenant Commander John Sharp's volumes and discover some very, very interesting and credible names, starlight marquee names, as a matter of fact, in the American political establishment, that portion of it anyway, that has been critical, appropriately critical, of Bush's war for empire and his war on terror in the Middle East. One of those voices is Noam Chomsky. Very respected Noam Chomsky of MIT. Lieutenant Commander John Sharp apparently got Chomsky to be one of the contributors to these very fine volumes. It's absolutely amazing that somebody of Chomsky's reputation, generally identified with the American left, of course, rather than the American right, but that whether you're talking about Chomsky on the left or you're talking about Paul Gottfried of Elizabethtown College up in Pennsylvania on the libertarian right, or you're talking about Pat Buchanan on the paleocon right, all of these individuals were contributors to the volumes of Lieutenant Commander John Sharp entitled Neocon and Neocon Again. It seems that when we start talking about anti-Semitism and supremacism, we need to define what it is we're talking about. And we also need to define who is writing these definitions for the U.S. Navy. Is it the Southern Poverty Law Center? Is it the Anti-Defamation League? Are these leftist organizations dictating American military policy as it relates to the administration of internal affairs within our various branches of the armed forces? Are we dealing with a situation where the legitimate expression of concerns about public policy within the armed forces, in the academic arenas of the Navy and the Air Force and the Army and the Marine Corps should be stifled when it comes to criticizing Israel and when it comes to criticizing a neoconservative foreign policy largely being driven by American Jews? It seems, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League, and it certainly seems that according to the establishment-driven wing of the United States Navy, that these kinds of conversations are out of bounds. That's very tragic, not simply because it is utterly ludicrous to indicate that Noam Chomsky and Pat Buchanan and Paul Gottfried, among others, are involved in activities that could be legitimately construed as anti-Semitic, if we applied a proper definition to that term, It's utterly ludicrous to see any of these people as being involved in what we would think of as supremacist movements and organizations. So inherently ridiculous are these charges that if the public had the opportunity to examine up close what the Navy is saying in this regulation 1167, and to see who and what it is that is pushing the Navy toward this very unfair persecution and prosecution of Lieutenant Commander John Sharp. And if John Sharp's volumes, his academic volumes entitled Neocon and Neocon Again, could be brought before the proper bar of justice, which is the court of public opinion, we would begin to see how quickly the Navy's case would fall apart in terms of public credibility. We would begin to see the public, I would assume, wanting to know more about the Southern Poverty Law Center and Morris Dees and just what his shtick and agenda happened to be, as well as that of the Anti-Defamation League. So all of this provides the context, then, through which we should read what Noam Chomsky has to say today at Tom Englehart's Tom Dispatch. Dr. Chomsky speaks of preventing a war with Iran. He indicates that stopping a war with Iran requires a strong, organized, popular opposition. Chomsky then goes on to say that unsurprisingly, George W. Bush's announcement of a surge in Iraq came despite the firm opposition to any such move of Americans and the even stronger opposition of the thoroughly irrelevant Iraqis. It was accomplished by ominous official leaks and statements from Washington and Baghdad about how Iranian intervention in Iraq was aimed at disrupting our mission to gain victory, an aim which is, by definition, noble. What then followed was a solemn debate about whether serial numbers on advanced roadside bombs, or IEDs, were really traceable to Iran, and if so, to that country's Revolutionary Guards or to some even higher authority. This debate, quote-unquote, is a typical illustration of a primary principle of sophisticated propaganda. In crude and brutal societies, the party line is publicly proclaimed and must be obeyed, or else. What you actually believe is your own business and of far less concern. In societies where the state has lost the capacity to control by force, the party line is simply presupposed. Then vigorous debate is encouraged within the limits imposed by unstated doctrinal orthodoxy. The cruder of the two system leads, naturally enough, to disbelief. The sophisticated variant gives an impression of openness and freedom, and so far more effectively serves to instill the party line. It becomes beyond question, beyond thought itself, like the air we breathe. The debate over Iranian interference in Iraq proceeds without ridicule on the assumption that the United States owns the world. We did not, for example, engage in a similar debate in the 1980s about whether the U.S. was interfering in Soviet-occupied Afghanistan, and I doubt that Pravda, probably recognizing the absurdity of the situation, sank to outrage about that fact, which American officials and our media, in any case, made no effort to conceal. Perhaps the official Nazi press also featured solemn debates about whether the Allies were interfering in sovereign Vichy France, though if so, sane people would then have collapsed in ridicule. In this case, however, even ridicule, notably absent, would not suffice, because the charges against Iran are part of a drumbeat of pronouncements meant to mobilize support for escalation in Iraq and for an attack on Iran, the quote-unquote source of the problem. The world is aghast at the possibility. Even in neighboring Sunni states, no friends of Iran, majorities, when asked, favor a nuclear-armed Iran over any military action against that country. From what limited information we have, it appears that significant parts of the U.S. military and intelligence communities are opposed to such an attack, along with almost the entire world. Even more so than when the Bush administration and Tony Blair's Britain invaded Iraq, defying enormous popular opposition worldwide. The results of an attack on Iran could be horrendous. After all, according to a recent study of the quote-unquote Iraq effect by terrorism specialists Peter Bergen and Paul Cruikshank using government and RAND Corporation data, the Iraq invasion has already led to a sevenfold increase in terror. The Iran effect, quote-unquote, would probably be far more severe and long-lasting. British military historian Corelli Barnett speaks for many when he warns that, quote, an attack on Iran would effectively launch World War III, unquote. What are the plans of the increasingly desperate clique that narrowly holds political power in the U.S.? We cannot know. Such state planning is, of course, kept secret in the interests of security, quote unquote. Review of the declassified record reveals that there is considerable merit in that claim, though only if we understand security to mean the security of the Bush administration against their domestic enemy, the population in whose name they act. Even if the White House clique is not planning war, naval deployments, support for secessionist movements, and acts of terror within Iran, and other provocations could easily lead to an accidental war. Congressional resolutions would not provide much of a barrier. They invariably permit, quote-unquote, national security exemptions, opening holes wide enough for the several aircraft carrier battle groups soon to be in the Persian Gulf to pass through, as long as an unscrupulous leadership issues proclamations of doom, as Condoleezza Rice did with those mushroom clouds over American cities back in 2002. And the concocting of the sorts of incidents that justify such attacks is a familiar practice. Even the worst monsters feel the need for such justification and adopt the device. Hitler's defense of innocent Germany from the wild terror of the Poles in 1939, after they had rejected his wise and generous proposals for peace, is but one example. The most effective barrier to a White House decision to launch a war is the kind of organized popular opposition that frightened the political military leadership enough in 1968 that they were reluctant to send any more troops to Vietnam, fearing, we learn from the Pentagon Papers, that they might need them for civil ordered control. Doubtless Iran's government merits harsh condemnation, including for its recent actions that have inflamed the crisis. It is, however, useful to ask how we would act if Iran had invaded and occupied Canada and Mexico and was arresting U.S. government representatives there on the grounds that they were resisting the Iranian occupation, called liberation, of course. Imagine as well that Iran was deploying massive naval forces in the Caribbean and issuing credible threats to launch a wave of attacks against a vast range of sites, nuclear and otherwise, in the United States. If the U.S. government did not immediately terminate all its nuclear energy programs, and naturally dismantle all its nuclear weapons. Suppose that all of this happened after Iran had overthrown the government of the United States and installed a vicious tyrant, as the U.S. did to Iran in 1953, then later supported a Russian invasion of the U.S. that killed millions of people, just as the U.S. supported Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran in 1980, killing hundreds of thousands of Iranians, a figure comparable to millions of Americans. Would we watch quietly? It is easy to understand an observation by one of Israel's leading military historians, Martin Van Creveld. After the U.S. invaded Iraq, knowing it to be defenseless, he noted, quote, had the Iranians not tried to build nuclear weapons, they would be crazy, unquote. Surely no sane person wants Iran or any nation to develop nuclear weapons. A reasonable resolution of the present crisis would permit Iran to develop nuclear energy in accord with its rights under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but not nuclear weapons. Is that outcome feasible? It would be, given one condition, that the U.S. and Iran were functioning democratic societies in which public opinion had a significant impact on public policy. As it happens, this solution has overwhelming support among Iranians and Americans, who generally are in agreement on nuclear issues. The Iranian-American consensus includes the complete elimination of nuclear weapons everywhere, 82% of Americans, and if that cannot yet be achieved because of elite opposition, then at least a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East that would include both the Islamic countries and Israel, supported by 71% of Americans, would be indicated. 75% of Americans prefer building better relations with Iran to threats of force. In brief, if public opinion were to have a significant influence on state policy in the U.S. and Iran, resolution of the crisis might be at hand, along with much more far-reaching solutions to the global nuclear conundrum. These facts suggest a possible way to prevent the current crisis from exploding, perhaps even into some version of World War III. That awesome threat might be averted by pursuing a familiar proposal, democracy promotion, this time at home, where it is badly needed. Democracy promotion at home is certainly feasible, and although we cannot carry out such a project directly in Iran, we could act to improve the prospects of the courageous reformers and oppositionists who are seeking to achieve just that. Among such figures who are or should be well known would be Saeed Hajjarian, Nobel laureate Shirin Ebadi, and Akbar Ganji, as well as those who, as usual, remain nameless, among them labor activists about whom we hear very little. Those who published the Iranian Workers' Bulletin may be a case in point. We can best improve the prospects for democracy promotion in Iran by sharply reversing state policy here so that it reflects popular opinion. That would entail ceasing to make the regular threats that are a gift to Iranian hardliners. These are bitterly condemned by Iranians truly concerned with democracy promotion, unlike those supporters, quote-unquote, who flaunt democracy slogans in the West and are lauded as grand idealists, quote-unquote, despite their clear record of visceral hatred for democracy. Democracy promotion in the United States could have far broader consequences. In Iraq, for instance, a firm timetable for withdrawal would be initiated at once, or very soon, in accord with the will of the overwhelming majority of Iraqis and a significant majority of Americans. Federal budget priorities would be virtually reversed, where spending is rising, as in military supplemental bills to conduct the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, it would sharply decline. Where spending is steady or declining, health, education, job training, the promotion of energy conservation and renewable energy resources, veterans benefits, funding for the UN and UN peacekeeping operations, and so on, it would sharply increase. Bush's tax cuts for people with incomes over $200,000 a year would be immediately rescinded. The U.S. would have adopted national health care, and so forth and so on. Folks, I think as you read through this, you can see that those of us on the paleo right would oppose a lot of what Noam Chomsky is talking about here in regard to some of his priorities involving the UN and the utilization of American government intervention in certain things at home that do not constitute a domestic policy that is governed by the enumerated powers clause of the Constitution. Nonetheless, I think what Chomsky is talking about here that we would be in agreement with is that the present-day American foreign policy in the Middle East that is governed by certain ideas about Iran and certain ideas about Iran that I believe in turn are related to certain perceptions about Israel, that Chomsky is right on in that arena. And so in certain things we dreadfully oppose him, in other things we affirm that what he is saying has validity. But the point is that when you read the entirety of what Chomsky has said today in his piece for Tom Englehart's TomDispatch.com entitled Preventing War with Iran, it becomes very clear that there are several things about Noam Chomsky that absolutely are not true. Is Noam Chomsky a supremacist? Is Noam Chomsky an anti-Semite? That's ridiculous on its face, isn't it? And yet Lieutenant Commander John Sharp, formerly of the USS Carl Vinson, is being accused of these things. For, among other things, having Noam Chomsky's writings in several of Commander Sharp's own volumes on neoconservative policy. This is very, very strange business, and I think underscores the doublespeak with which we can evaluate what is going on with the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League and an American government, which seems to be very happy to let the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League run the domestic and foreign policy of the United States and run the internal policies of the United States military, including the USS or the United States Navy. So we'll keep an eye on all of this in the days that are ahead, but suffice it to say that as we look at what is happening in the Middle East, what is happening in our domestic policy, that these things have the fingerprints of Israel and the domestic Jewish lobby in this country all over them, that we would be remiss in our responsibilities to you as journalists if we did not call it the way we see it. This is certainly the way I see it, and I think all of the available qualitative and quantitative evidence points in that direction. And that's something that we'll be chatting with Mark Glenn about here when he comes on a little bit after 8 o'clock this morning Central Time. By the way, here's an interesting story for you. How many of you trust government when it comes to keeping certain data about you confidential? I don't know how many of you file tax returns. I don't know how many of you out there sign all kinds of forms that give various governmental agencies of the United States so-called confidential access to who and what you are. I presume that includes a great deal of you who listen to this broadcast. look today at a post that you can find at a place called Science News. That's at SCIAM.com. SCIAM.com. And if you have trouble finding it there, at scientificamerican.com, which is SCIAM.com. I believe Lou Rockwell has this posted on their front page today. But here's a story indicating that there is an absolute confirmation that the U.S. Census Bureau gave up the names of Japanese Americans in World War II. According to J.R. Minkle's post for Scientific American, dated March 30th, government documents show that the agency, in this case the Census Bureau, handed over names and addresses to the Secret Service. Reading a little bit of Minkle's piece here, he says that despite decades of denials, government records confirm that the U.S. Census Bureau provided the U.S. Secret Service with names and addresses of Japanese Americans during World War II. The Census Bureau surveys the population every decade with detailed questionnaires, but is barred by law from revealing data that could be linked to specific individuals. The Second War Powers Act of 1942 temporarily repealed that protection to assist in the roundup of Japanese Americans for imprisonment in internment camps in California and six other states during the war. The Bureau previously has acknowledged that it provided neighborhood information on Japanese Americans for that purpose, but it has maintained that it never provided microdata, quote-unquote, meaning names and specific information about them to other agencies. A new study of U.S. Department of Commerce documents now shows that the Census Bureau complied with an August 4, 1943 request by Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau for the names and locations of all people of Japanese ancestry in the Washington, D.C. area, according to historian Margot Anderson of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and statistician William Seltzer of Fordham University in New York City. The records, however, do not indicate that the Bureau was asked for or divulged such information for Japanese Americans in other parts of the country. Anderson and Seltzer discovered in 2000 that the Census Bureau released block-by-block data during World War II that alerted officials to neighborhoods in California, Arizona, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, Idaho, and Arkansas where Japanese Americans were living. Quote, "We had suggestive but not very conclusive evidence that they had also provided microdata for surveillance," unquote, Anderson says. The Census Bureau had no records of such action, so the researchers turned to the records of the chief clerk of the Commerce Department, which received and had the authority to authorize interagency requests for census data under the Second War Powers Act. Anderson and Seltzer discovered copies of a memo from the Secretary of the Treasury, of which the Secret Service is part, to the Secretary of Commerce, who oversees the Census Bureau, requesting the data, and memos documenting that the Bureau had provided it. The memos from the Bureau bear the initials J.C., which the researchers identified as those of then-Director J.C. Capt. What it suggests is that the statistical information was used at the micro level for surveillance of civilian populations, Anderson says. She adds that she and Seltzer are reviewing Secret Service records to try to determine whether anyone on the list was actually under surveillance, which is still unclear. Quote, "The new evidence is convincing," says Kenneth Pruitt, Census Bureau director from 1998 to 2000, and now a professor of public policy at Columbia University, who issued a public apology in 2000 for the Bureau's release of neighborhood data during the war. Quote, "At the time, available evidence held that there had been no release of microdata," unquote, he says. "That can no longer be said," quote unquote. The newly revealed documents show that census officials released the information just 7 days after it was requested. Given the red tape for which bureaucracies are famous, quote, "it leads us to believe that this was a well-established path," unquote, Seltzer says, meaning such disclosure may have occurred repeatedly between March of 1942, when legal protection of confidentiality was suspended, and the August 1943 request. Anderson says that microdata would have been useful for what officials call the mopping up, quote-unquote, of potential Japanese Americans who had eluded internment. The researchers turned up references to five subsequent disclosure requests made by law enforcement or surveillance agencies, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation, none of which dealt with Japanese Americans. lawmakers restored the confidentiality of census data in 1947. This page then continues on to discuss yet a series of other things that are very, very disturbing. And I would just commit that entire article to your consideration. You can find it at scientificamerican.com. This is a story that was originally posted on the 30th of March. I believe Lou Rockwell has a front page reference to it today, and it quite clearly is an indication that during the Second World War, your confidential U.S. Census Bureau data actually fell into the hands of a variety of U.S. intelligence agencies and was ultimately used to intern people who were simply Americans of Japanese ancestry. This is a very, very interesting story, I think, not simply because of what happened then, what happened in the 1940s, but for what is happening right now. Are you, for example, if you are listening to this show, a Persian American? Are you, for example, an Arab American? Are you an American who does not fit those two ethnic categories, who is someone who has been peaceably and legitimately outspoken in opposition to government policy in the Middle East? How do you feel about Mr. Bush's war on terror? Have you said anything publicly about the USA Patriot Acts 1 and 2? How do you feel about the Military Commissions Act of 2006? What's your perception of the revelations that the National Security Agency has been conducting warrantless spying operations on thousands of Americans, according to what has appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post in the last year or so? How do you feel about those things? Are we seeing a repeat of what happened in the 1940s? I would suggest very strongly that we may well be seeing a repeat of such things, which brings us again full circle to the Sami Al-Aryan story. We've talked about it several times before on this show. Dr. Al-Aryan's wife, Nayla, was a guest on Mark Nankoff's America some days ago. In this particular instance, we are talking about the fact that Dr. Sami Al-Aryan, a so-called Palestinian American, was a professor of computer science at the University of South Florida. Mr. Al-Aryan had been accused of a series of things by the United States government in 17 counts, indicating that he was a supporter of various terroristic causes and terroristic groups. Mr. Al-Aryan, Dr. Al-Aryan, was subsequently tried by a jury of his peers in Florida on these 17 counts. He was acquitted on either 8 or 9 of these charges outright, and the remaining charges saw a hung jury. But it is notable that the jury that was hung on the remaining charges, actually by a vote of 10-2, wanted him acquitted on those charges as well. The international media and the national media in this country at the time, indicated that this story about Dr. Sami Al-Aryan was a test case for the United States government and in its utilization of the USA Patriot Act in the prosecution of people in this country who were deemed in the judgment of the government to be subversives, to be people who were in actuality or potentially supporters of enemies of this country, however the Bush administration chooses to define that, and who are potential or actual supporters of terrorism. It is noteworthy that in the case of Dr. Sami Al-Aryan, that he continues to languish in federal detention in the Raleigh-Durham area, even though he was never convicted of a thing in an American court of law. Acquitted of basically half of the charges, you had a hung jury on the remainder of the charges, but a 10-2 majority wanted him acquitted on all charges. The long and the short of it is that after all of this was said and done in the American courts, he is still in custody. Still in custody despite the fact that he finally came to an agreement with the U.S. Justice Department where he would plead guilty to a token charge in exchange for his freedom from federal detention and in exchange for his right to return with his family to Palestine. That agreement was subsequently reneged on. And as it stands today, he is still in prison in the Raleigh-Durham area. He has been undergoing a hunger strike for quite a number of days now. He has had an alarming declension in health, and his wife and kids are still languishing in Florida, not exactly knowing what the future holds. This is his present situation. Could this be your situation or my situation in the future? Let's face it, folks, I am, if you want to define me politically, a Taft Buchanan Republican. I think you know what I mean, even though I am really out of the Republican Party now. I dropped out officially in 1996. Nonetheless, if you wanted to peg me politically, I am an America First guy. I am a believer in the original intent of the United States Constitution, according to the founders of this country. I believe in the basic foreign and domestic policies that would characterize George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and Andrew Jackson and a few other people. That's basically who I am. In the modern period, you would peg me as a Taft Buchanan Republican. I believe in this country. I believe in what was the culture of this country prior to the events of the last 40 years. I'm a Christian, an Orthodox Christian. I believe that wars need to be fought in conjunction with the Constitution of our country about who decides when we go to war and what the purposes are for our going to war in any given conflict. That the ultimate yardstick there is it in the interest of the United States, the people of the United States, or isn't it? Or are we meddling in foreign affairs that, as in the words of Washington, are entangling alliances and situations in which we should not be involved. The list goes on and on. I'm a pro-life Christian. I believe in the protection of all of human life. I believe that the Constitution says a lot more about that than any alleged right to an abortion, according to the legal thinking of Harry Blackmun. You could go on and on with the things that I believe as an American. But when I say that I am a Taft Buchanan Republican, I describe myself that way so that educated people politically who have some semblance of what those terms mean can define me in a nutshell. Is a Taft Buchanan Republican a subversive? Is a Taft Buchanan Republican someone who hates America? Is a Taft Buchanan Republican someone who does not believe in individual freedom? Is a Taft Buchanan Republican someone who does not know fundamentally what it means to be an American? I think all of you listening to this know that that would be inherently absurd, criminally absurd, for anyone to come to the conclusion that I, or anyone else representing my brand of political ideology, is a threat to this country. We are patriotic Americans in the best sense of the word, and being patriotic Americans indicates that we support the Constitution of this country. We support Washington's farewell address foreign policy. We support the sanctity of human life. We decry the movement toward a degenerate spiritual and moral culture in this country. We want a strong military, but a strong military that is used to defend this country and its vital interests here. We want effective policed borders, and we want to ensure that people who immigrate to this country do it legally and legitimately, and that they are people who will add to the economy and to the culture and to the political structures of our land and will not detract from those things. Does that make me a subversive, folks? If it does, then I suspect that most of you listening to this broadcast are also subversives. But boy, we could sure be defined as that, couldn't we? If we suggested that we think the war effort in Iraq is bad policy, if we suggest, as Lieutenant Commander John Sharp has, that the Iraq war does not meet the Augustinian test for just war, if we were to suggest that we are tired of the Jewish lobby controlling the domestic and foreign policy of this country, there are those out there who would say that we are subversives, that we should have our freedoms curtailed, that we should be harassed, that we should be denied the opportunity to make a living, and that in a worst-case scenario, we should be involuntarily incarcerated, maybe even denied the writ of habeas corpus. Want a lawyer? Can't have one now. want the government to have to explain its charges against you? They don't have to. And that's according to a federal judge in the Jose Padilla case, who indicates that when the Pentagon defines you as an enemy combatant, that the federal government of the United States can simply jettison the Constitution and do whatever it wants to in your given case. Now, there are lots of Americans out there, for naive reasons or something more ominous, would not have a problem if those things are being done to a guy named Jose Padilla, who would not have a problem if those things were done to somebody whose name was Sami al-Aryan. But when we start talking about the Smiths and the Joneses of America, the point is that what is being done to Padilla today, what is being done to Sami al-Aryan today, could well be your fate or mine tomorrow if our government is not bound by the chains of the Constitution, and if we do not stand up to oppose what we believe to be bad, immoral, egregious foreign policy abroad in regard to this impending war with Iran, that is something that no thinking America, left, right, or center, should be in support of. For all of the reasons enumerated today by Noam Chomsky in his piece for Tom Englehart, that have been enumerated by those of us on the right, including Pat Buchanan and others, who have forcefully spoken of the dangers of this situation. We could be dealing with the end of the American Republic, folks, if we're not careful. This is a very, very serious situation, and one that we should be on top of in the days ahead. Let me set something here as I am seeing a message coming up on my board. Hold on just a second. Just responding to Mark Glenn of Crescent and Cross, who indicates that he will be ready for us after the commercial break. Just writing back to say, we'll be ready, bub. So that's the situation today as we have it in foreign and domestic policy. This is where we are at this juncture. And whether we're talking about Noam Chomsky's piece at Alternet or we're speaking about this point being made by Scientific America on the 30th of March, that the U.S. Census Bureau did give up names of Japanese Americans in World War II to intelligence agencies, who subsequently used this information to unconstitutionally and illegally incarcerate these American citizens, that we, in fact, could see it happen again. By the way, there's a good complimentary piece to what Noam Chomsky has said today in regard to preventing war with Iran, and that is something that you can find at lourockwell.com that has been team-written, presumably, by both Dr. Chomsky as well as Tom Englehart, and it is entitled, What If Iran Had Invaded Mexico? I would alert you to that piece and ask you to take a look at it in the days ahead. I'm hearing from Harmony Grant today, the National Prayer Network. She has a specific series of things that she pens this morning in something that is entitled Resurrection Freedom. I'm not going to read the entirety of the text over the air, but I would again suggest that all of our individual listeners would well nigh profit by being involved in the news serve of Ted Pike's group, the National Prayer Network. This latest piece entitled Resurrection Freedom by Harmony Grant underscores that when we think of Easter weekend, both those of us who observe that because of tradition, as well as those of us who believe that that is not a part of biblical tradition in terms of the Easter celebration, but nonetheless believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead as a historical event, that all of these thoughts of Harmony Grant today at the National Prayer Network are well worth keeping in mind. Let's take a look at then. It's something that I posted yesterday for Breaking All the Rules News. Mark Glenn and I will be talking about it shortly when he joins us. And that is the whole question of what happened to the USS Liberty. And when we look at this whole issue of the USS Liberty, if you go to Breaking All the Rules News and look for American Memory, you will see an article entitled Captain Ward Boston and the USS Liberty Investigation. Cover-up. See Dr. Hisham Talawi's Current Issues Television. And this show on Tuesday, April 3rd, is something I want to discuss with Mark Glenn because I understand he was also on that television show. But in the text of that article, I make reference to U.S. bankruptcy judge Jay Crystal. I had never heard of this guy. until the other day when we had a guest on the show from the USS Liberty, Commander Dave Lewis, coming to us from Vermont, who was relating not simply Dave's experiences from June the 8th, 1967, but Dave in turn went on to say that he personally had been attacked by a U.S. federal bankruptcy judge named Jay Crystal for Dave Lewis's testimony in regard to what did happen to the USS Liberty in June of 1967. You may recall that Commander Lewis indicated that this U.S. federal bankruptcy judge, Crystal, spelled with a C, operating and living in Florida, had published some articles and given talks which supported the official Israeli government version of what happened on June the 8th, 1967, namely that this whole business was a case of accident and mistaken identity on the part of the Israeli military and the Israeli government. I believe, of course, that that's nonsense. I think you can fairly describe that as a pack of lies. And that Mr. Crystal, you may remember, was someone who, according to Commander Dave Lewis of the USS Liberty, had traveled to Israel on 13 separate occasions before publishing what I refer to in this American Memory piece as the Jewish Party Line on what happened on June the 8th, 1967, to the USS Liberty. If you're looking at that article, even as I'm speaking, I put a link in there to a very, very interesting piece by a guy named William Hughes. And William Hughes has a piece that you can find online if you search for Judge J. Crystal, spelled with a C, and it's entitled The USS Liberty Smearing Backfires. And this is an article that Mr. Hughes penned, I think, 4 years ago, talking about who Aaron J. Crystal really is and why he may have been involved in wanting to discredit the crew of the USS Liberty. And it compares Mr. Crystal's credentials to be making these statements with those of the crew members of the USS Liberty. Aaron J. Crystal, according to William Hughes, is a self-described amateur historian. We might underscore that concept. And Crystal has written a book entitled The Liberty Incident, which is a pro-Zionist apologia for Israel. And in that regard, William Hughes tells us that Crystal, now in his 70s, has worked mostly as a bankruptcy judge, and that is in turn a federal sinecure that doesn't need congressional approval. He has a non-combat background in the U.S. Navy. I'm going to discuss some of this more specifically with Mark Lim when he comes on this morning. But interestingly enough, William Hughes is corroborating something that I observed at the time when Commander Dave Lewis was on this show. And that is that this guy, Crystal, is somebody who has absolutely no credentials at all to be talking about the USS Liberty. This guy is not an intelligence expert. He is not a serious military historian. He has a non-combat background in the U.S. Navy, to quote William Hughes. He was not present on the USS Liberty on June the 8th, 1967. And on top of that, is relying upon the accused, in this case the government of Israel, for his so-called data to disprove the claims of the crew members of the USS Liberty in regard to what they saw and experienced that day. And as you read through Hughes' piece, I think it's very, very instructive in regard to the kind of thing that goes on routinely when it comes to disinformation movements being operated by the Jewish lobby and the government of Israel to put spins on their version of events and their version of historical evidence that proves to be time and again a pack of lies. And I have put William Hughes' piece on this bankruptcy judge, J. Crystal, into my post on Dr. Hesham Talawi's interview with Ward Boston that now appears at Breaking All the Rules News.